Sabbath of the month. Kodesh is the word for month, not to be confused with Kadosh or some such variation, which is the word for holy. They sound alike, but they're slightly different. Sabbath of the month. And why is it a special Sabbath named Sabbath of the month? Any ideas? Oh, none? Oh, come on, guys. Don't be bashful. Because this is the Sabbath right before the beginning of the month of Nisan, we're coming up on the new moon. Remember, the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar. Every month, Jewish month, starts with the new moon. That would make the middle of every Jewish month in the full moon. But there is a special reason why this particular month, coming up the first of Nisan, is particularly important. Any ideas why? It's the first of the year. Nisan is the first month, which means that it's like the beginning of the year. Not to be confused with Rosh Hashanah, which is in September, usually, which is translated as the head of the year, Rosh Hashanah, which is thought of as the Jewish New Year, but it's really in the seventh month. I know it sounds weird, and it's like one of those things that just, it's like you have to figure out. And it's for outsiders, it's sometimes difficult. Do you remember the scene in the movie with Harrison Ford and Gene Wilder? Gene Wilder plays a little Jewish rabbi, and Harrison Ford plays an outlaw. And they somehow become friends. And Gene Wilder is explaining to Harrison Ford about the Sabbath. And he says, no, I can't ride my horse on the Sabbath. The Sabbath is on Saturday. And Harrison Ford says something like, but this is Friday. But Gene Wilder says, well, but for Jews, Saturday starts on Friday. Because the Sabbath actually begins at sundown on Friday evening. And so Gene Wilder says in his nice Ashkenazi Eastern European accent that he's imitating, he says, but for us, we don't ride horses on the Sabbath, and which is Saturday, and for us, the Sabbath starts on Friday. And so I know it sounds confusing, but this next week is the beginning of the month of Nisan, and it is the first month on the Jewish calendar. So this is a special Sabbath. This is like the Sabbath before New Year's, except, well, one of the New Year's, like I said. And so I have a little joke. I don't know how to turn it into a joke, but next week, the first of Nisan is on Tuesday. And what is the Gregorian date of Tuesday? Does anybody know? Tuesday is April 1st, and it is also Nisan 1. And so you can tell all your friends, today is the Jewish, today is New Year's. And you can say, and that's no April Fool's. So anyway, I just found it interesting that Nisan 1 falls on April 1st, which is April Fool's Day. So I'll let you have fun with that. Okay? So it's interesting that according to Jewish tradition, the very first commandment that God ever gave to the Jewish people is found in Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12 contains the very first commandment given to the Jewish people as a whole, as a community. Of course, there were commandments that get incorporated post-date before that, going all the way back to creation. But the first commandment was when God told Moses that this month, the month of Nisan, would be their first of months. God was changing the calendar. Up until that point, Tishri, the seventh month, in the autumn, when we celebrate Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, that was the first month. Let me tell you a story to help you understand how it got switched. This is from the Midrashim. There's a story about a king who has a son, and his son is born in 1 month, and all the kingdom celebrates that particular holiday, celebrates with the king the birth of his son, and it becomes an annual event throughout the year. But the time comes when the son grows up and he's abducted. He's kidnapped by a neighboring kingdom. And all the people of the king's land mourns until the time comes when the king's son is brought back home. He's rescued. He's redeemed from the foreign kingdom that has captured him and is keeping him captive. And from that time, then all the land of the king celebrates the rescue of the king's son. Time goes on and they continue to celebrate on an annual basis the rescue of the prince. So much so that the celebration of the prince's rescue from the foreign nation surpasses even the celebration of his birthday. So thus, in the same way, Rosh Hashanah celebrates the birthday of the world. According to Jewish tradition, at the time of Rosh Hashanah, God created the heavens and the earth. But the time came when the first month, the month of Nisan, gained the supremacy because that was the month that God rescued his people from bondage and slavery in Egypt. It surpasses even the celebration, even the thought of God as creator, God as rescuer, God as redeemer, God as deliverer of his people, takes on even added dimensions and heightens our understanding of God so much. So, we have what is like a Jewish New Year next week on Tuesday. So that is why this is called the Sabbath of the month. The month meaning Nisan, which is not the car that you drive or I drive, but it is the name of the Hebrew month. There is, as Aaron told us in his Parsha highlights, that there is a special reading, since this is a special month, there is a special reading for this particular Sabbath. And it comes from Ezekiel chapter 45, about halfway through chapter 45, through about halfway through chapter 46. It's a fascinating section of the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel is a major prophet of Israel, But he's a lot different from Isaiah, who was the prophet of comfort in Israel's time of exile. He told Israel that you have broken God's covenant, you are going into exile, but there is about half the book of Isaiah is messages of comfort and hope because the exile is going to end. Jeremiah came along. He was the prophet, well, they call him in some circles the weeping prophet, the prophet of anguish, the prophet whose heart was just broken. In fact, at one time, Jeremiah told God, God, I wish that you wouldn't even make me be your prophet. I don't want to be your prophet. But your words within me are so strong, I have to say them. They're going to come out of my mouth like fire. They're burning so much within my heart. According to Jewish tradition, Jeremiah's words were indeed so strong that he was executed by the very people he was wanting to bring a message to. They couldn't handle the dynamic of Jeremiah's message from God. Ezekiel, the third greatest prophet during the first temple period of the Jewish people, is different from even Isaiah and Jeremiah. He's a prophet of visions. He's a mystical prophet. He just call him weird. You can read him, and he has images that are very different from anything else that we read of in Scripture. And in the last 8 or 10 chapters of the book of Ezekiel, there is a vision of a temple that is unlike the temple that is there when Ezekiel is writing his prophecy. It's a vision of a temple that's not like Solomon's temple. In fact, the temple that was later built by Zerubbabel, and we call the Second Temple period, or that was modified by King Herod in the generations before Messiah. It's not like that either. It's a temple that there's never been a temple like that at all. In fact, the sacrifices that we even read about in this week's reading from Ezekiel 46 are not like any sacrifices that we read of. In fact, we're told that the sacrifices that are brought in this temple on the Sabbath day is not like any of the sacrifices that Moses talked about. They're different. They're weird. They're strange. And even the measurements of the oil and the flour that are to be brought are different than what Moses taught in times before Ezekiel. And in fact, it led the rabbis to even scratch their head and wonder, is this book even inspired? Did God really breathe this? Is this given by God, or is this guy out to lunch? And what they decided was Ezekiel was okay, because somehow what Ezekiel was envisioning was a temple, an ideal temple, something that would be perfect in the heart and the eyes of God, or some other of our sages said that, well, it wasn't so much that it was the ideal temple, but it was the temple that was to come in the days of the Messiah. The temple in the days of Messiah. And that is where I come down. That is my perspective and focus. And we're going to see that in some beautiful ways
Chapter 45, verse 16 says, all the people of the land will give an offering for the prince in Israel. And it will be the prince's job to make the burnt offerings and the meal offerings, the drink offerings in the feast and in the new moon, that is at the first of the Jewish month, the new moon, and in the Sabbath, or on the Sabbath, and on all the appointed seasons of the house of Israel. The prince will prepare the sin offering and the meal offering and the burnt offering and the peace offering to purify the house of Israel, meaning the people of Israel, the Jewish people. House of Israel is ancient Tanakh Bible language for the people of Israel. I find this very interesting that in all these chapters in this part of Ezekiel, when Ezekiel is describing this temple that doesn't look like Solomon's temple, and sacrifices that weren't brought in Solomon's temple, sacrifices that were even, gasp, not the sacrifice of Moses. Some other, where did he get this idea for these sacrifices? This is so much different. One other thing that is unique to this section of Ezekiel is that Ezekiel puts this character called Hanasi, the prince, Hanasi. Ezekiel puts the prince in charge of overseeing what goes on in this temple. These verses talk about how the people of the land bring an offering for the prince of Israel. And it will be the prince's job to make the burnt offerings, the meal offerings, the drink offerings on the feast, on the new moons, on the Sabbath, and all the other appointed seasons of Israel. The prince prepares the sin offerings, prepares all these for Israel. It's the prince doing this, not the high priest. If you read Leviticus or Deuteronomy or Numbers or Exodus, you'll see that there was someone called Kohen HaGadol, the high priest, who would officiate over the worship of Israel. But did you know that in this portion of Ezekiel, in this unique temple, not once is there mention of a high priest? It mentions priests, but never a high priest. This is very odd, very strange, and the rabbis, to some extent, have no explanation for what's going on. They said, this is something, and then they posit different explanations, and some say this is just something we don't understand. A little later on in the portion, we have this beautiful description that when the people come into this temple to worship, they only come in to the temple when the priest, when the prince, the Nasi, when the prince is there. When the prince comes in, then the people file in. And it gives this great image of the gates around the temple. And there's a gate on the north side, and there's a gate on the south side. If the people come in from the north, they file through, but they don't turn around and go back out the same gate that they came in. They instead file through and go out the gate on the other side. And vice versa. If people are coming in, they have multiple entrances. But you just don't come in and wander around and then go back out the same way. But you cross all the way through. If you come in from the south, you cross through and you walk through. And when you're done, you leave by the north gate. The prince comes in from a different gate. He comes in from a gate on the east that is opened, according to chapter 46, just for him. Just for him. It's opened, we're told, on the Sabbath and on the new moon. A special entrance for just the prince. He has his own gate. Some of the exploration that I did, it said that perhaps this idea of people filing through, coming in this side, exiting from the opposite side, was some sort of crowd control, maybe. But I go, well, but if then the other people come through from the other direction, what's the point? As I got studying this portion, it was amazing to see that right in the center of this temple complex was the heart of the place where they would meet the prince. The prince would meet them in the center, in the middle. And those gates, when they came through, it means that they would traverse right through the middle of the temple complex. To me, the point is, not for crowd control, but if they came in from one side and had to exit the other side, that means that they would have to pass right by the prince, right by where the prince, whoever he is, would be waiting there. They could only come in, we're told, in chapter 46, in this Haftorah reading, they could only come in when the prince is there. It's an amazing, weird, and unusual image that Ezekiel has. Different sacrifices, different temple, no high priest, the people filing through in ways that we don't see anywhere else in any other, in the tabernacle, in the temple that Solomon built. And who is this prince? Who is this prince that sets up and administers? Nowhere does it say he's a priest. Nowhere does it say he's the high priest. Nowhere does it say he's a Levite, a descendant of Levi. It just says the prince will officiate these things. The prince will be there when the people come in to worship on the Sabbath and on the new moon. Who is the prince? And what is this all about? I'm glad you asked. I'm going to look back at Ezekiel chapter 34 to answer the question. And well, because I have just a moment, I'm going to ask a question. Somebody tell me, what is your favorite psalm? 139, I know that one. How about someone else? 1691. Somebody else? 24. Okay, well, you're not playing along with me. Okay. 131. In some Bible numberings, there is a 151. So I'll let you figure out what that's about. The answer is it's 150, but nobody said Psalm 23. Okay, I was hoping somebody would say Psalm 23 because perhaps it's the most famous. How does that one go? The Lord is my shepherd. Adonai Roi. Very good. I will not lack. He leads me by green pastures. He guides me by still waters. He renews my soul. And then this good shepherd who leads me and feeds me and provides for me, then he does something doggone strange. He leads me right up to the table where my enemies are sitting. He says, he sets a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You know, why couldn't it have been in the presence of my friends? I would like that more. But even there in the presence of my enemies, it says, I'm with you. My rod and my staff, they comfort me. He fills my cup. My cup overflows. Goodness and mercy will indeed pursue me all the days of my life. You know, we talk about, you know, getting ahead in life. We talk about pursuing whatever, you know. We exercise because we want to be healthy. We invest, we save money because we want to be secure. We pursue these things. But in God's image, it's the other way around. As we walk with Him, goodness and mercy pursue us as we let Him be our shepherd. So it's an interesting picture in that last verse of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. So back to Ezekiel. I brought up Psalm 23 for a reason, because Ezekiel 34 continues this theme about shepherds. Sometime read Ezekiel 34 in its entirety, along with Psalm 23. It's very interesting. It says, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, speak against the shepherds of Israel. Say to them, this is what God says. Woe to the shepherds of Israel who have fed themselves on the sheep. You ate the fat and you clothed yourself with the wool and you killed the fatlings, but you didn't feed the sheep. It's an image of certain leaders who, instead of being reflecting God as the good shepherd, they become bad shepherds. Instead of tending and caring for the sheep, they eat the sheep, they bite the sheep, you know. It's an amazing thing. Sheep bite, sheep kick, but good shepherds don't bite and kick back. And they care for the sheep. And so this is what God says. What does God say? God says, the time is coming, in verse 24, the time is coming when I will appoint one shepherd over them, and he will feed the sheep. This is after God takes care of the bad shepherds. God says, I'm going to give a shepherd who will feed the sheep, my servant David, and he will feed them and he will be their shepherd. Now, recognize that when Ezekiel writes this, King David has been dead for 400 or 500 years, a really long time. So when he says David will feed them, Ezekiel is picking up on a tradition that assigned to this image of David the likeness of Messiah. An expectation of a messianic age, a messianic Messiah to come who would be like David, who would have a heart for
for God and a heart for the people like David had. David becomes an image of Messiah. And so, in fact, in the very first verse of the New Covenant Scriptures, in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, it says that this is the genealogy of Yeshua, the Messiah, Jesus, Yeshua, the son of David. Connecting Yeshua as the Messiah with King David, pointing out that Yeshua was the David-like figure expected. Back to Ezekiel 34, it says, I will appoint one shepherd over them, over Israel, my servant David, meaning the Messiah, and he will feed them, and I will be their God, and my servant David will be a prince among them. David will be, we're told, the Nasi, the prince among Israel. So who is the prince we read about 10 chapters later? If the Messiah is the prince identified in chapter 34, then who is the prince in chapter 44 and 45 and 46? Though some of the commentators and the scholars choose to disagree with me, what the gall of them, and say, no, this doesn't have any connection. Reading Ezekiel in context, if Ezekiel points to the Messiah-like figure and calls him the Prince of Israel in chapter 34, then when you get to 44 and 45 and you're reading about how the prince will be the one that orchestrates worship and makes the sacrifices for the people, and the people can only come worship when the gates are open, and the gates are only open when the prince is there, so the prince is the center of worship, then in my mind it is still the speaking of Messiah in a temple that hasn't been seen. Why have we not seen Ezekiel's temple? Why is it different? Why are the sacrifices even different? Well, quite frankly, we have not yet envisioned and seen in our time, in our history, in the scope of the generations, we've not yet seen the temple officiated by a prince, the Messiah, not tied to a Levite. Messiah himself, the one directing the worship, providing for the worship in the temple. It's interesting that if you read this section closely, you'll see that it also mentions other Jewish holidays like Passover and Tabernacles, Pesach and Sukkot. Those other wonderful Jewish holidays that speak of Messiah. In the temple envisioned that we can only dream about and speculate about, there is Yeshua at the center, guiding and directing. Could this idea be where the writer of Hebrews perceived the idea that Yeshua was a high priest? Not quite like the high priest like Aaron, because Aaron was descended from the Levites. No, this high priest, Yeshua, is a different kind of high priest altogether. He is the prince, the good shepherd, who will take care of the people and feed them we see in chapter 34 of Ezekiel. And then in chapter 45, we see that he is the prince that guides and directs our worship, that provides the sacrifices, that offers the sacrifices. Yeshua is the heart of our worship. Yeshua is the focus of our praise. Yeshua is the heart of our blessing to the Most High. What's at the center of your worship? What is it that guides and directs your thoughts? Make sure that, as that song that we sang earlier, when we come in to the temple, take me past the outer courts, bring me right into the middle of it all, that song says or implies that we sang. Take me in so I can worship. It's interesting that as we look ahead to the, if you want to call it a Jewish New Year next week, no kidding, no fooling, April Fool's Day, let Yeshua be the heart of your worship. As we look forward to Passover, let Yeshua be the heart of our focus, the heart of our direction.